Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live off of the Hubbin Book Group studio in Doppeltown, USA, it's Necro. I'm a par with your hosts, Mike Stoffel and Mike Marcana, episode 104, Richard Matheson's Hell House. The story of a house and the people it hates. And now, Necro.
Hello.
Here we are with the second of our deep dive authors, Richard Matheson.
What's that? Are you still hating the experiment?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, actually, this one's working much better. Well, we'll see when we get to the third. The third book. Yes. For this episode, we read Richard Matheson's Hell House, published 1971. And
I was surprised that it was 1971.
I was too. I thought it was going to be earlier than that.
I thought it was like a 1940s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were sexual situations that would not have fit the 1940s, 1950s.
I know as I was reading through the book, or actually as I was being whispered into my ears, I was very aware of that this was a book written by an author who had gotten his start in the 50s, when certain rules about writing were in place. You couldn't say certain things. But those rules had fallen by the wayside by 1971. And you can just see him sort of...
like tentatively...
clutching his pearls and dropping boom? An F-bomb. Yeah. And it's great because I think Richard Matheson was a fairly earthy dude. But he knew that the rules were there, and he understood why they were there and how they were profitably broken. If you're going to drop the F-bomb, if you're going to have frank sexual situations, you do them with great effect. And he does.
Well, that's when when I was reading it, I thought this is early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And then when some of that stuff, I'm like, what? And then I had to go and look at the copy page. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Because it has that, what's that word I'm thinking of? It has that flavor, right?
Yeah.
It's that kind of a story.
Yeah.
It's gothic, right?
It's a mid-century gothic novel.
Yeah. And it follows the convention of the haunted.
And it does it really well.
It really, yeah.
So I'll just splash right out here and say, I love the book. I just loved it.
It was a tonic for the last book.
I was so thoroughly entertained, I really liked the interplay of the characters, which is really what haunted house books really work. It's, you know, you put this cast of characters in a house or on an island, and you tell them to survive.
Right.
And they and in that doing that, you get to do all this great character stuff and rub the characters against each other and see where the sparks fly.
Right.
And Richard Matheson has a good time doing it in this book. And
he does. I couldn't help but read this and think of that rotten haunted house book that we read called House.
Oh, the Christian one.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how much better this one was.
I know. I was thinking about that a little bit. House. Ted Decker and...
yes.
I can't remember who the other
Jimmy author Prosciutto was. Or something like that.
Yeah, that wasn't so successful. I think that one depended on already understanding a lot of evangelical theology that I don't.
And they didn't drop any F-bombs.
And they didn't drop any F-bombs.
And there was nobody was biting a boob.
Nobody bit a boob. No.
There wasn't dry humping.
Yeah. No
ghostly dry humping.
No ghost humping. So this book is, it partakes wholeheartedly of that, the spend the night in a haunted house genre, which I'm not exactly sure how old it is. This is one of the pillars of that genre.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. this one and before it is Shirley Jackson's.
You mean how old the genre is?
Yeah, like well, how
old didn't we read a book like from the 1830s that was the same? It was a haunted castle.
Yeah, but you have the haunted castle, but you don't have the people like spending the you know the
having
the,
to spend the night yeah. to prove something.
Yeah, exactly. Or, some rich guy or some you know professor or something like that saying spend the night in the house or having a bat. Saying, okay, that spend the night in the house.
Yeah, I think that comes out of the spiritualism.
Yeah.
Or spiritism is the actual, the spiritism. Yeah. Movement. Movement. Yeah.
Late 19th century.
Where was that? Like, they thought they were a science.
Mm-hmm.
That they were proving something scientifically.
Yeah.
I did a whole paper on it in college.
Oh, did you now?
I did.
That's
why they had all the equipment and all the
yes.
the boxes and all the this and the that to
yep.
the physical evidence.
I found it very amusing in this book that you have the spiritist what was her name of the Hollywood woman Florence who is a, sort of a medium she you know runs seances.
Right.
And you have another.
She's a mental medium, not a physical medium.
Yeah, and you have the physical medium Benjamin Franklin.
Fisher,
who is a survivor of an earlier disaster in the house,
and he's a physical medium,
so he can conjure.
He can
things.
Manifest,
yeah, ectoplasm.
And he was a prodigy at age 13 or something.
13 to 15, yeah, and then you have
the doctor,
a skeptic, which, as far as skeptics go, he is pretty credulous by our standards. Because he talks about all the scientific evidence, which
right.
doesn't really exist.
No.
I did.
He was a man sort of stuck in.
But he was.
He was stuck by his idea.
Yeah. But he was trying to be. He was trying to be scientific. He was trying to be scientific. It's a very strange position to take, to my sensibility, that you know he studies spiritualism or you know. What he calls not supernatural but supernormal phenomenon.
Right, that's all part of the
yeah,
natural world.
Supernormal. So I did a little clicking around at the reading about Richard Matheson today, and he was way into this stuff.
Oh,
he was a
like
believer.
Seriously,
yeah,
into
seriously,
it?
He was oh. he was a believer. He was really into the science of it, and he thought it was a science.
Oh,
And you know, so did a lot of people in 1971.
Parapsychology.
That was the heyday of parapsychology.
And psi force and
yep.
all that.
Yep, and the cards, like, you know, look at the card and the person
calls. I had those
cards. Do you really?
I had them.
Oh, excellent.
As a kid.
And Uri Geller was in his heyday.
Spoon bending.
And
Pyramid power.
And pyramid power. Oh, yeah, all of it. What? But he's trying to be hard-nosed. So he's supposed to be, like, the skeptic. And, a skeptic these days would say, you know, nothing is happening. You are making this all up, and there is nothing to see here, and you sure as hell aren't, you know, emanating these things from your own subconscious. But his scientific thing is that, you know,
this is a manifestation of somebody's unconscious. So,
yeah, somebody's unconscious, not somebody's some dead person's consciousness.
Right, it's not a dead person.
It's not a dead person.
Right. It doesn't. There's no proof of the afterlife.
Yeah, so which is what they're there to do. So they have this rich guy who is afraid of dying apparently, and he wants proof of the afterlife. Proof of what do they say? Survival.
Yes.
Mental survival, or mental personality survival. And in the end, they get it.
And he's already dead.
Yep. But he's already dead, so he never gets it.
He never gets it, and they don't get paid.
Well, as you know, as far as a hard-nosed scientific guy goes, I can't believe he went in there without having a signed contract.
That's true. All of them.
All of them. They're idiots, and they deserve to die. Well, no.
And then there's the wife. It's Edith. Dr. Barrett, and his wife is Edith.
Yeah.
And Edith is... There's always that one fragile,
yes,
yes, barely on the edge of sanity
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Person in these stories, and she's that.
Yeah, you can kind of map the four characters. I don't remember. I never read the Shirley Jackson novel, but I know I sort of have memories of the movie that was based on it, The Haunting of Hill House.
I had a hard time not transposing those two.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because there was sort of the sultry woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the soldier who's a lesbian.
Who's a lesbian, who's Florence.
You have the mousy woman who is not willing to admit that she's a lesbian.
And she's not willing to, and she's also not, might have been a lying about being psychic.
Yes.
And then you had the doctor, or like, and then there was some other character who I don't remember.
I can't remember
either. There was four or five in that as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think The Haunting of Hill House is very much present in Richard Matheson's mind when he's writing this. And going forward, I think Hill House is very much in Stephen King's mind when he writes The Shining.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I never thought of that, but yeah.
Yeah. And Stephen King's very, very upfront about saying that Richard Matheson is one of his heroes, one of his models, and he writes about this particular book in that early collection of nonfiction book that he did.
What's
it called? The Night Something or Other.
Right.
I read it a long time ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, but this is a kind of, and you know, it's, and Stephen King is right to use it as a model. This is how you do it. It doesn't get any better than this.
So what do you think were the good parts about it? Other than the characters,
I was genuinely I felt the delicious dread, you know, that Scooby-Doo, I'm watching Scooby-Doo dread, you know, that goes, you know, to the, you know, I'm this is why I enjoy being frightened a little bit, because this is the exact right admixture of fun and fear, as they're getting ready to go to the house, and the way the house slowly reveals itself. And, you know, all the spooky trappings, like the chapel with all the blasphemous imagery and the weird swimming pool and the is this the first time in literature that somebody's been trapped in the sauna? Possibly. I don't know.
There's a weird swamp thing outside.
The tarn, which is straight out of the Fall of the House of Usher.
Right. And there's like the weird couple that feeds them, but they only show up and then they run away. And don't go into that house.
There were so many red herrings.
And then all the walls, all the windows are bricked up.
Bricked up, yes.
I could not have gone into that house.
No. It was spooky. It was very spooky. And all the red herrings that, you know, I was like, oh, I totally have this figured out, and then.
What was
one point I thought that Dr. Bennett?
Barrett.
Dr. Barrett didn't realize that he was a psychic, and that his subconscious was causing things to happen.
Oh, that would have been good.
That would have been good. Which is, it wasn't, so yeah, so that one moment when he's, when the resonator starts coming to life again, I thought, he's doing that. And that actually would have been a good working out.
That would have been, you know, so this is really, did you ever see, so the theory of poltergeists, not the movie Poltergeist, but perhaps, is that this phenomenon needs certain types of people as batteries. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like, does the Pope shit in the woods if you don't hear him?
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Is there a ghost unless there's somebody
there
to active...
To power
the ghost. An interaction of something.
Sure.
So that definitely is in this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the phenomenon becomes more powerful as it interacts As it's observable.
Yeah.
I have to say, I knew I was sort of gripped when Florence is certain there's a body buried in the wall, and they're digging, and I'm like, oh, I hope they find it. I hope they find that. I hope they prove her right.
I know. I mean, I was...
And even then, Dr. Barrett wouldn't believe it. Like,
yeah. I mean, I was very sympathetic with all the characters. The least sympathetic character in the end, frankly, is Dr. Barrett. But Because he's so stubborn. But you're favorably disposed to him for a long time, more than you normally would be, because his is the consciousness that you're in at the beginning of the book. So you assume that this is your hero, and you stay with him for a while.
That's yeah.
And so he sort of front loads his sympathy, and then as he becomes less and less likable and more rigid and everything sort of evens out, and then you realize, well, maybe it's the physical medium. Maybe it's, you know, they're all very positive characters.
with their flaws.
And brave in their own way. Yeah.
And they're also all partially correct in their own way.
Say more about that.
Well, let me say. Florence was right that that these the powers were not coming from her. They were moving through her. The doctor was wrong. She was wrong, however, by...
That it wasn't Danny.
She was fooled. She was fooled. And then...
And it was picking up on her unconscious desires.
It was, yes.
The same with Edith. It picked up on her unconscious lesbian desires and her horniness.
Yes.
Her unrequited horniness.
Unrequited horniness.
I can't stop looking at these photographs of debaucherous. This is horrible. Turn the page.
Oh, there's more on the other side. Hold on a second.
This thing's going up other things.
Things going into other things. The physical medium.
Florence.
No, not Florence.
Benjamin.
Benjamin, was he actually might have been able to figure things out sooner, but
he was so closed off.
He was so closed off, and he was right to be.
Because being open to Balot.
Belasco?
Belasco was the downfall.
Yeah, it was the downfall. And Dr. Barrett's skepticism served him very well.
Well, and his resonator would have worked
if
he would have figured out there was a lead-lined room.
Yes, he was right.
Except he was right.
Yeah. And Edith...
Edith, well, she wanted to leave.
She wanted to leave,
and she was probably right.
She was probably right. Yeah, she was a strange character. Matheson had to sort of walk a fine line, because she's so timid and so codependent, on her husband.
Bitch slapper.
Yeah, you wanted to smack her around until she started to get some spine. Although, was it her or was it the house that was giving her the spine? Because then she becomes more, more likable. But it's not really her. And if she's so timid, why is she in the house at all?
Because she didn't want to stay home by herself.
But this house is clearly worse.
Right. But her aloneness was even worser.
Yeah, I know. The slapping the slapping would have done some...
She needed a good screw.
That is a very 70s...
That's almost every character. Right. And almost that's every character in this book needed a good screw.
That is at one.
Oh, I can relate.
At a basic level, that is true of every character in the book.
Oh, it feeds the hungry ghost.
Feeds the hungry ghost.
I have to say the one scene I did not like,
which was
the crazy cat scene.
Oh yeah.
Because I was having PTSD from the Resnick book about the cat wars.
Oh, the cat wars.
Oh, here we go with another cat losing its mind. And why was that fucking cat there in the first place?
Who knows?
It bit her bosom.
The cat bites her on the bosom. Yeah, no, there was some pretty gory bits in here, too. Really well placed and, not overly... It wasn't throughout the book, but every once in a while, when Florence dies,
got it the worst.
Yeah, Florence really, really. It was hard to.
She was ghost raped.
Yeah, she was ghost raped there's a blasphemous crucifix.
Yeah.
And she's impaled.
Phallus.
She's impaled by the phallus on the crucifix, and it's awful.
Yeah, that's awful. It's awful.
It's awful. On a lot of different levels, and. But very effective. It's just that one scene, and you're like, oh, that's gonna stick with me. It's not smeared in a bunch of other scenes like that. It's just that one crystal image. I'm like, oh. So do you remember seeing this movie? Because this was made into a movie.
I never saw the movie
3 years later. Maybe we should watch it sometime. I did, and I remember nothing.
I want to watch it. It's on Amazon Amazon.
Yeah, you can rent it off of Amazon for like $3.
Yeah. Roddy McDowall plays the Benjamin character,
mm-hmm.
which I could not when I was reading the book, and I could not think of him.
Oh, really?
As the Benjamin character.
That's funny. As I'm listening to the book, I know that he's the character, and I just it didn't register at all. I saw some guy with a pretty serious limp, in his 50s.
That was Barrett.
That was Barrett. And Roddy McDowall at that point was probably in his 40s.
Maybe even his 30s.
Yeah, he was
he was really young when he got, he was in his teens when in the 50s.
Yeah,
when it's those movies. But
right.
But I was mixing the young Roddy McDowall up with the Frighteners Roddy McDowall.
With the Planet of the Apes Roddy McDowall. Strictly speaking, they're very different. Right. With the Riddler. Was that Roddy McDowall? No, he was the bookworm.
Yeah.
It's a Batman reference for those of you of a certain age.
And I had Liam Neeson as Barrett, who played in The Haunting of Hill House.
See, Liam Neeson would have been good.
But Liam Neeson played in the remake of The Haunting of Hill House.
That's right, which was terrible.
And then I had the woman from... The Haunting of Hill House, the mousy woman who dies in the end because she's going up the spiral staircase because she's sort of...
Claire Bloom?
Was that...
In the original one?
In the original. That wasn't Claire Bloom, was it?
I can't remember. Claire Bloom
She was always the... played these mousy... And she's like a little sprite. She looks like a little sprite.
But Claire Bloom was really small. Anyway.
She was Edith.
Uh-huh.
And then Florence was like some kind of like dark lady.
Tallulah Bankhead.
Some kind of dark lady with big hair.
Vampiro.
Sort of like a dark version of Marlo Thomas. That's the kind of hairdo.
I kept seeing like an old Veronica Lake.
Oh.
Yeah. Blonde.
Oh.
But
blonde. I did not see her as a blonde.
I saw her
as a brunette.
They probably actually said, and one of us misread it.
Well, she had sort of a Romanian, she had sort of a lusty. I loved Edith sort of getting all, her bosom and looking down at her naked crotch and all that. And she's getting all blushed inside. And what is this feeling?
That must have been pretty saucy for... I mean, I think this book, when it came out, was made kind of a splash because it was... I think it was pretty daring. Because this is before Exorcist.
You think it was daring?
At the time? In 71?
Oh, wow. I have a hard time believing it was daring.
I wonder. I have no specific knowledge. I have nothing to compare it to. But, like, when did The Exorcist come out?
Well, that's a good question. The book?
The book.
Boy, I don't know. I want to say 74, but I think that's when the movie came out.
Yeah, I think you're right.
74, 76. So it might have been around the same time.
And Rosemary's Baby was late 60s.
Yeah, that was in the 60s.
But horror writing at this time, I don't know that it... Well, maybe we'll have to find out. Maybe we'll do... That'll be one of our deeper dives is like late 60s horror to see how... If it's gory or sexy or
there's that overlay of sex, mm-hmm. which feels very 70s to me.
Very 70s,
late 60s, early 70s. Free, and the backstory to this house is there's like, it had a Manson-esque feeling to it, right? Because it was sex and then cannibalism and all these crazy things, and they all die. And
it was like a Bella Puck, a Spawn Ranch.
Yeah,
I mean, it was. I mean,
it sounded like that,
and it was also sort of like sort of calling back to those Dennis Wheatley novels about the satanic stuff.
Right, the horrible thing, the looks on their faces as they're doing horrible things to each other, grunting and groaning like animals.
Like animals. In fact, Richard
Matheson... Which is The Exorcist, too, right?
That's right. In fact, Richard Matheson wrote the screenplay for the movie version of The Devil Rides Out, movie that we saw a couple years before this.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that was in his head. I'm sure he had, absorbed Dennis Wheatley at this point. And
there's that whole thing about the satanic... debauched,
mm-hmm.
The crimes against nature
yep.
feeling to this,
It's like, let's take a beautiful thing and make it ugly. And then have other people watch us while we do it on the kitchen table. Right.
And they walk into the chapel. Oh, look at this wonderful chapel. Oh my God, the stained glass! What are they doing?
So another thing that I enjoyed about this this book was something that I guess was probably introduced in with Dracula, was which was the use of technology to address the supernatural or supernormal. So we have the resonator, his resonator machine, and we have trying to use, you know, the temperature gauges and all that stuff that we remember, like the people our age will remember from Poltergeist, you know, when the parapsychologist researchers come in and they have all that equipment and video cameras and temperature gauges and headphones with tape recorders and all that kind of stuff. That's all here.
Yeah, it is all here.
I don't know that it was, like, I don't know that it was in, like, The Haunting of Hill House, the Shirley Jackson book, or in any other earlier ones. I know there's...
I think there might have been thermometers, because I remember the temperature dropping, and they're like, oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the scenes with Florence were scary, and her whole sort of being pulled into this relationship, and then discovering she's been duped and it's too late, mm-hmm. and the you know, there is no point of view. I mean, you're in everybody's head.
Yeah.
So, and then that struggle with Benjamin Fisher, right?
Mm-hmm. Ben Franklin Fisher.
His struggle of trying to, like, wanting to conquer this.
Yeah, I mean,
knowing that he has this ability and he's just been keeping it under wraps.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, he's there to just basically cash his check at the beginning.
Kind of.
But by the end.
He's kind of there, but he's also wanting to prove something.
Yeah.
Because he actually experienced.
Yeah, and that part of him grows throughout the book until finally, in the end, he's sort of the hero.
Well, yeah, well, they also keep calling on him to be a hero.
Yeah.
Get him out of the... He's stuck in the sauna, or she's about to fall into the pool. She wants me to rape her.
Exactly. So the book's not very long. So what was it? You read it on an e-reader. So I'm guessing, it was nine hours long audio, so that's about a 200-page book.
All right.
But it moves very fast.
Yeah.
I wasn't spending every minute listening to it, and I found myself finishing it in like 2 days, 2.5 days.
So, what do you think of the ending? Because the ending is slam bam.
Yeah, the book has this momentum, and it just keeps ratcheting up and gets more and more frenetic and crazy and chaotic. Until you get to the very end,
where you think they've won.
Yeah.
Like, there's like a conclusion, like, oh, yeah. It worked.
We've turned, and there's another hour and a half of the book left.
Right.
And you're like, I'm only 78% through with this book. I got to read some more. Of course it was a false ending.
Yeah.
Which
so many false walls in that chapel.
Exactly. It's a lead-lined ending.
So here's where... This is where it lost me.
Really? Okay.
Yes. It's because they had to come up with this funky-ass reason.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the lead-lined room. It's the lead-lined room. Of course. Because the ghost hid in there.
Yes.
And, of course, lead doesn't... This keeps ghosts out, or what? It just seems so slapdash.
Well, it was
like they had to come up with some kind of science too.
Yeah, I mean, the resonator was like a magnetic? No, it was radiation. It resonated some kind of radiation and lead.
Like it ionized. What it did was it ionized the atmosphere.
Yeah,
and so. When the ghost knew what was going on, it retreated into this room when the resonator went off, and that's why when they were finished, they couldn't feel anything. They couldn't feel. They didn't feel any powers left in.
Well, the energy. Ghost more than knew. The ghost sort of like
he tricked them
intuited it in the 1920s or 1930s, and when he had the room built.
Right, and he built that room for that purpose.
Yeah, which is, well, it's hard to say.
Again, another sort of like, oh, really?
Yes, it's a little stretchy.
It's a little stretch, and that's what it, that's what it.
I can see being a little incredulous about that.
Yeah.
In a very credulous genre. But yeah, that was a step too far.
Because that's the thing, things have to be believable within
the rules you set up.
The rules.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like, oh, we've got to come up with another rule. You know, because wouldn't it have been smart to go, well, are there any lead-lined rooms in this house anywhere, possibly?
Yeah, is there anything that would keep this from working?
Right.
I mean, where was the lead-lined room?
It was in the chapel.
It was in the chapel, but it was behind
the wall or something.
Yeah, so.
Well, Florence, her dead self, like, didn't she pull a little piece of...
Right, she did.
...of wallpaper?
Yes.
And that's where Fisher goes, oh.
It's lead, yeah.
But somehow they got the ghost to come out.
Yeah. I mean, one partial defense is that the chapel was the room that they were most afraid to go into. It was very difficult for them to go into and to discover and...
Right.
To explore.
It was the creepiest.
It was the creepiest. So there were reasons for them not to have spent any more time in there than they absolutely had to. So maybe that's part of, the narrative control there.
It is, but they had to come up with some weird science to explain it. That's the thing. It was sort of like, okay.
Yeah. The weird science was very...
the other science...
Was charming.
Charming. I guess that's... Right.
It was very fine gobbledygook.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if you could write that this way, days.
You'd have to come up with something
with physics,
other gobbledygook.
Something.
Yeah, like quantum entanglement or right. string theory or right. something like that.
Right. Ball of string theory.
Or multiple multiverses.
String cheese theory. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, so that was the only thing that, here's the other thing that kind of struck me that I don't think you could write today either. So that whole idea of when the medium is in contact with the spirit and then it produces ectoplasm, which gives, like, the spirit can use to then manifest kind of in the physical world. Well, nobody thinks... I don't know what they were thinking in the 70s, but nobody thinks that happens anymore.
No.
I don't think.
No.
I don't think, you don't see pictures of people taking pictures of ectoplasm.
Yeah,
or,
I mean, there were pictures of mediums extruding ectoplasm.
Back in the 1800s.
Yeah,
and
it was all fake.
Right.
But here they have an explanation that it's harvested dead skin cells and mucus and things like that from the medium itself.
Right, I think I don't think that he came up with that. I think that's what they also thought.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was also different lines of thought, but I think they also thought
that.
But you don't, you know, every. So if you watch these ghost, reality shows,
oh, yeah, like
right?
Ghost Hunters, yeah.
They don't have, and they bring mediums in all the time. Nobody's saying they do that. Like, there is no ectoplasm anymore.
Not since Ghostbusters.
No, not since
just occurred to me that the resonator in this thing is essentially...
It's exactly
the thing on the
it
Ghostbusters
exactly
back.
Is. It exactly is. So that was... I don't even know if it was of its time. I don't know if the 70s where people were still thinking that's how mediums manifested spirits was through ectoplasm.
Yeah.
But that you couldn't write that today.
No.
Nobody thinks that.
No, people don't cotton to it. They have no truck with it.
And that idea of having that box, building that box so that these these things could happen in this box in a controlled manner. I don't think they don't do that anymore.
No. I mean, I don't know what sort of... I mean, there's the reality. I'm doing air quotes here. TV shows are like Ghost Hunters and things like that. But I don't know. Is there any serious research into parapsychology going on?
I have no idea.
I
know there's
no
a
either.
Local Doppeltown parapsychology investigation group, but I don't. They use EM readers a lot, and that tape recordings and stuff like that. But I don't know. I have no idea. Somewhere. Well, okay. I think it's time to cut down.
It's pretty simple, but also strangely fussy.
It's not that fussy.
Well, anytime,
how fussy is it?
Anytime you say "get a champagne flute," you're talking fussy.
Yeah, you don't need to do. You don't have to do a champagne flute. You can do a juice glass.
Or a Pilsner glass.
Yeah,
yeah. Just something, ideally something taller than it is.
So here's what you're gonna have to go get. You're gonna have to go get some absinthe.
Yeah.
You're going to have to go get some raw sugar cubes. So they're going to look, not brown sugar cubes.
Raw sugar.
You want raw sugar cubes, they look brown.
Yes.
You're going to have to go get some grapefruit bitters.
I know Fee's makes it. I'm sure other companies make it.
And you're going to have to go get a dry, sparkling wine like Cava. Mm-hmm. Or what's the German one?
There's Sekt. There's various German dry, sparkling Rieslings and things like that.
Or if you could find a rosé that's dry, they do exist. That would be
nice.
But
you want some tiny bubbles.
So, take the
glass.
Take the sugar cube. Put the bitters on it.
Yeah, put it in the glass. Put a couple drops of bitters on it.
Pour in
ounce of absinthe. And then, and ideally, you will already have your champagne cold. Fill it with champagne.
Have icy cold.
Icy cold. Yeah.
And just fill it with the champagne.
And what you'll see happen is that the absinthe will make the champagne very cloudy and weird looking, almost like ectoplasm.
Yes, we could have called it ectoplasm, but we're calling it
the Resonator because whatever. Whatever spirits are rattling around in your head will be demagnetized and dead by the time you're done with three of these.
Unless you're wearing lead-lined underwear.
Or lead helmet.
Then you're a lead helmet. But it's pretty good, actually. It's surprisingly good.
Yeah, it's a strange mixture of tastes, but it grows on you like a fungus. So.
Or like ectoplasm.
Or like ectoplasm. So, the Resonator.
Well, let's head on down to the basement. But we already know what we're reading, but let's go down there anyway.
Let's go down there anyway, because it's cooler down there. It's usually warm in the state of the time.
We're down in the basement now.
Here we are. So, I think we should read something by Richard Matheson.
Well, surprise, surprise, Gomer. So our next book is Stir of Echoes. Hooray, hooray.
Hooray.
Excited to read it.
I started it today.
And
pretty excited.
Yeah.
In fact.
And then just line up for the next one.
Yeah.
What is the next one?
I have a suggestion. It's one of his late, one of his later horror novels.
That's what we want.
It's a weird western. It's called Shadow on the Sun.
All right, Shadow on the Sun.
Yeah. So the next two books.
The next two books.
Stir of Echoes and Shadow on the Sun. So.
But we won't be reading them all at once. We're gonna read Stir of Echoes.
Yep.
And then we'll podcast it.
Yeah.
All right. All right, let's get out of the basement.
Let's do it. So I have a confession. Well, not a
confession. Oh, okay.
I don't have a confession. It's not a confession.
You didn't finish the book again. It's a new habit for you.
No. I read it.
Okay.
All the way through. No, I'm in between these books, I've been reading other Richard Matheson shorter things.
Okay.
Like today I read Duel.
Okay.
Which is, did you ever see that movie with Dennis Weaver?
No, I didn't.
It's worth your time. If you ever have it in front of you, watch it. But it was a good story. A really good story. So I'm gonna listen to some of his other short stories too, like Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, which became that famous Twilight Zone episode, and Button, which became that movie The Box. And just a couple of other stories. Or remember the movie The Trilogy of Terror?
Yeah,
those are all his stories.
Oh,
all three of them.
So why do you think his writings lend themselves so much to the visual?
Because half the writing he did was script writing.
Okay.
Yeah, he was a Hollywood guy.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, the script for Hell House, the Haunting of Hell, or what was it called? The Legend of Hell House. He wrote that script.
Oh.
He wrote the script for The Incredible Shrinking Man, based on his book. And he did scripts. He did all those Edgar Allan Poe scripts for Roger Corman, and he wrote did the scripts for a bunch of Hammer House movies.
Oh, okay.
He did a bunch of Twilight Zones and Night Galleries. He did the script for both of the Kolchak movies. Night Stalker
and Night Strangler.
He did both of those.
Two of my favorite TV movies.
Oh yeah, those left an impression on an 8-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah, I still remember that stick going into that vampire.
Yeah, yeah.
Look on his face.
Yeah, I actually went to the very disappointing Seattle Underground tour simply because I wanted to see the.
Yeah, because that's where that takes place.
The first one.
I think the first one.
Yeah. No. The second one. The first one was in L.A. The second one was in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
So it's a nice strangler.
Oh, yeah.
Who turns out to be, like, immortal Jack the Ripper, played by Oscar Goldman from The $6 Million Man. Oh. That one made an impression.
All right. So we should have said this at the beginning of the podcast. I wanted to put out a personal apology to anybody who listens to us. We had a heck of a time getting our last episode uploaded.
Oh my God.
And we thought it was uploaded and it wasn't. And Internet Archive was messing with us. And it took a long time to get that sucker up there. But we think we got it figured out. So
we'll find out.
We'll find out. Oh man, what a clusterfuck.
A total clusterfuck. But we actually, you know, I have to say, to the credit of the Internet Archive and also to Mr. my colleagues, perseverance. They actually gave us an answer, in so many words that
we put
into action,
and it worked.
And oh my God, if only Comcast could do the same,
right? Or anything. Yeah. So I just wanted to put that out there, and hopefully we won't have that problem again in the future. But who knows? It's the internet, so of course there's going to be problems.
Yes, of course.
Right. And technology. Yeah. All right. Anything else about this book?
No, I don't think so. I'm glad we read it. I'm glad we're reading Richard Matheson. I'm glad my dive is going to be pretty deep. I'm going to read a bunch of short stories too.
Right. Maybe you'll start seeing patterns then.
That would be lovely. My fear is that I'm going to start seeing patterns and get bored, and that would be not good. So I'll try to keep things in check.
All right. All right. So what should we do with this sucker?
Well, let's...
let's promise it $1 million, but not get a contract.
And drag it out of its lead-lined room.
And put it...
And just magnetize that fucker.
All right, let's do that. All right, so this thing is done.
Bye.
Bye.
Old Enoch, he lived to be 365. When the Lord came and took him back to heaven alive, I saw the light from heaven shining all around. I saw the light come shining, I saw that light come down. And Paul prayed in prison, them prison walls fell down. The prison keeper shouted, redeeming love I found. I saw the light from heaven shining all around. I saw the light come shining, I saw the light come down. And Moses saw that a burning bush, he walked it around and around. And the Lord said to Moses, you's treading holy ground. I saw the light from heaven shining all around. I saw the light come shining, I saw the light come down. Dry bones in that valley, got up and took a little walk. The deaf could hear and the dumb could tell a song. I saw the light from heaven shining all around. I saw the light come shining. I saw the light come down. Adam and Eve in the garden under that sycamore tree. Eve said, Adam, Satan am tempting me. I saw the light from heaven shining all around. I saw the light come shining. I saw the light come down.